over Baghdad has been illuminated. We're seeing bright flashes going on all over the sky.
And welcome to Radio Contra, episode 25. The home of the boys who are always down to boogaloo. That's right, the Mossy Oak Militia coming at you live from Northern North Carolina. And man, I'm surprised they haven't yanked me off the air yet. Oh wait, it's because I own the platform that I am coming to you on. Huh, how about that? In a world of all the deplatforming, people getting their voices squelched, what did we do? Created our own media platform. And we've become the fastest growing brand in the fight for freedom out there. Just over 2 years. 3 million views, averaging 12,000 hits a day, all because of you, our incredible readership, our incredible listenership, and the people who are out there in the real world who are actually getting it done. You're taking up the fight for liberty in real time, and I cannot thank you enough. So just a couple of days ago, there was a pretty big fireworks explosion in Lebanon. Fairly interesting. We posted the video up on AP. There was some stuff that was coming out of Twitter. And man, that was a big boom. Big. And you can see the aftermath of that. I was checking out some of the post-blast analysis coming out of it. And they felt shockwaves from it all the way in Cyprus. And there was one report that I saw that I didn't cross verify, but said that they had radiation from it that was coming all the way to Italy. And I don't doubt it. That was a big blast for anybody that saw it, saw the aftermath from it. Yeah, it was serious. And I thought that it was interesting that at the very beginning, they were saying, oh, you know, it's just a fireworks boat or whatever. And I knew that was a lie. Fireworks are normally just a real simple phosphorus compound and maybe another agent that's in there for a binary to create a little extra smoke or whatever. And that's pretty much it. And man, that thing, there were a lot of second and third order detonations going on before the big one. And looking at it now, we see that there was a fairly large warehouse that was on that dock that actually detonated. And we know now that it was a weapons facility, weapons storage facility that was being used. So, you know, I did a little bit of digging because the Middle East is kind of outside of my wheelhouse these days. I'm paying attention to domestic threats, a lot of stuff that's coming out of South America as well. And I'm not really focused on the Middle East anymore. I don't, you know, just as a personal thing, if something big happens, I'll pay attention to it. But I don't pay attention to the politics there anymore. It's not my job. But apparently there's been a rapidly deteriorating situation in Lebanon. And in case you don't know, Lebanon is not really what we would call a coherent state. It's just kind of a buffer zone between northern Israel and Syria. And it's controlled by a number of different competing interests. And we do know that Hezbollah has a major presence there and has for a long time. And of course, we know that Hezbollah is the terrorist arm, the international export arm of Iran. So you know, when we're looking at it through that lens, and that gives a little bit of context, the rumor is that there was getting ready to be an attack, and one of their weapons storage facilities got blown up. Don't know. Can't say, but I do know that Hezbollah has been very active as of late in the Middle East. They are very active and have a presence here in the United States as well, and even have ties with some prominent left-wing politicians and public officials. Rashida Tlaib is definitely one of the more outspoken supporters of Hezbollah and has been for some time, and I think it's really entertaining. Some of you leftists out there who are apologists for them try and claim that she's not, when you know damn well that she is. I mean, if I take pictures with someone and accept campaign donations from them, from their front groups, it's probably a pretty good indication that I'm acting on their behalf. I mean, I'm not a poli-sci guy per se, but I do know how things work in the real world. But, you know, just saying. But, I mean, Rashida Tlaib, I think she's kind of small fry outside of her district. And, you know, she's just there filling a seat. But somebody who does have Iranian connections, who is a lot more potent and a lot more dangerous, would be Valerie Jarrett. Yes, Valerie Jarrett, going back to the Obama administration. The rumor is, and these are pretty substantial rumors, is that Valerie Jarrett was one of the brokers for the Iranian weapons deal. Yeah, they got him a lot of money. And I think, you know, it's kind of funny that Reagan, back in the 80s, the Iran-Contra, the left really made a big show out of that. And there was some corruption going on. I mean, let's be honest. But looking at this, they want to sweep this under the rug. Oh, well, you know, how dare you? How dare you accuse her of being acting on behalf of a foreign hostile nation? You know, how dare you? How dare you? They only want nuclear weapons for peace, as a mutually assured destruction. I'm certain of it. Right? I'm certain of it. But you know, Valerie Jarrett's been kind of quiet as of late. Haven't heard a whole lot out of her for the past few years. Aside from her and some of her people, where it got leaked in the Washington Post in a random act of journalism, posted up that they were occupying a house right there in Georgetown in the Northern Virginia area. And I'm sure that they set it up, outfitted it with some significant signals intelligence collection equipment, and, you know, we know that the rest is history through there, with the revelations coming out, especially from John Brennan and James Clapper, so on and so forth. But the fact that Valerie Jarrett is now in the consideration for vice presidential, to be the vice presidential nominee on Biden's ticket, very, very significant. Very significant. And very dangerous. This is not a woman to be underestimated, and the fact that she doesn't appear much in public should be very, very telling to how much power she actually wields behind the scenes. So, I'll say that, where does all this intersect? Where do these things come together? There's a lot more than meets the eye. There's a lot that's going on behind the scenes. It's very interesting to see in the long run how this is going to break down. If you don't have what you need now, you might want to get cracking on that soon, as in today, because it might not be there in the near future. People are gathering up stuff just like squirrels before a storm. I want to address something that my friend and fellow author Matt Bracken wrote earlier this week, talking about the quote-unquote woke military and some of the things that he's observed, and I've shared some of those same observations of political correctness, kind of how I see things breaking down. You know, before I jump into that, I want to give a little bit of a context about the Russian Revolution. You know, when I was trying to go to sleep last night, it dawned on me that in the Russian Revolution, World War I was going on, and it wasn't going very well for the Russians and the Russian monarchy. So the Imperial Army, or the White Army, so to speak, as it was called, was having to quell the domestic insurrection that was the Red Army that was fighting. And their morale hit an all-time low, and they ended up defecting. That effectively ended the Russian Revolution in favor of the Russian revolutionaries, and the Soviet Union was born. The left learned long ago, I would say probably in the 1950s and into the early 60s, that butting heads with the United States military directly and politically was not going to work. So what they were going to have to do is infiltrate it and corrupt it from the inside very slowly. And I feel that at this point in time, that corruption has become blatantly obvious. Our military went from being a war-fighting entity to becoming a social experiment for the left. You know, this is where we find ourselves now. I had a first sergeant who was a Desert Storm vet. I mean, this guy was hard-boiled. Been shot a few times. He had, I think, 6 or 7 deployments plus Desert Storm to the Middle East. He was... the guy was a warrior. He was soft-spoken. He was a teddy bear to the guys he liked. But one thing that he absolutely had no tolerance for was what he saw as the breaking down of discipline over time. And one of the things that he used to pull me aside and say was that, you know, kind of doing the little NCOPDs, professional developments right off the cuff, that, you know, the Army is very different these days, and he fears that he doesn't recognize it. In a lot of ways, he was right. I'm not putting anyone down out there. You know, don't get it twisted. I'm not putting down anybody's lifestyle choices. I'm not gonna sit here and judge. I'm not a person to judge another person. It's not my place in the world, right? But one thing I will say is that we know statistically that you have transgendered people and people who can't really figure out what bathroom that they want to go to. They have mental illnesses, many, many mental illnesses. They have very little discipline. I mean, this is not me being a bigot or trying to say that they're necessarily bad people, but I will say they are completely unfit for military service. This is coming from my personal experience. They are unfit for military service. You know, the whole question of women in the infantry. No, I'm sorry. It doesn't work. You know, and I know that the Army has changed and, you know, they are allowing females in the infantry, and there's female Ranger School grads, and now there's even a female long tap in a female Green Beret. You know, here's the thing. It's not a question of necessarily physical capability. All right, even though it is in many cases, on average, now I know that some of you females are beasts out there. I get it. You know, that's all right, fine. But the thing is that across the board, on average, that is not the norm. The average man will outperform the average female, person to person, in physical capability when it comes to upper body and core strength tasks. It is a fact. It is demonstrated over and over and over again. And if you can't pick your buddy up and get them out of harm's way and get them off the X as a basic physical capability, then you are a liability to your team, period. This is not really up for debate. And so let's apply that to the larger role of the infantry. And I know also I've wrote some stuff on this, and both professionally and as a blogger and website owner. And the face of warfare has changed also. The set piece battles and stuff of conventional military things, not necessarily reflective of reality. But what I will say is this, is that while there are some very squared away females out there, ladies, there are some of you that really know how to take care of business. There's some good female shooters out there. That does not equate to meshing well with what is the infantry, the combat arms, and the pointy end of the spear of special operations. It doesn't mesh well. It leads to a breakdown in discipline in every case that I observed. I knew a guy, he was a first sergeant, and he took over a headquarters company. He got busted down to E7 from first sergeant and retired as an E7, all because he disciplined a female soldier the exact same way that he would have a male. He basically called her out, and she thought she could get by with her very slack, bad attitude, mouthing back to first sergeant. You take this guy, who's a 22-year career 11 Bravo, who's pretty salty, and from deep in the heart of Texas, and you're going to have this female junior soldier in a headquarters company who's, she's a paper pusher. She's going to mouth back to him. He's going to say something to her, and he did. Now, some of you out there might say, well, he should have handled that professionally and whatnot. But you got to understand that is professional. It is professional to go to another guy and say, hey, you're jacked up. Or, hey, get your ass in here, and fix it. In a guy's world, that works. That gets their attention. Hey, do this. And then from there, you can have that professional courtesy, but you have to establish dominance first. And what did she do? She walked right down the hall. She goes down to the SHARP/EO. SHARP is sexual harassment representative. The EO, equal opportunity representative. And then walked over to IG and filed complaints with each of those people. Well, this first sergeant who was squared away 100% of the time, all of a sudden, career comes to a screeching halt. Now this guy's getting busted down, all because he did his job. He did his job. He disciplined a soldier. It became a she said versus he said. And it's like the old adage that you're not even guilty until proven innocent. You're just guilty. Well, that's exactly what happened to him. So I tell you all that to tell you that, this idea of the woke military and that platoon leader, he very famously took a knee, he's National Guard platoon leader that took a knee. Don't know his name. I don't even remember which city it was in when it was going on. But I do remember seeing the photograph and the video footage from it too. And, you're there as an authority figure. A military force is there as an authority. You have to establish dominance. You know, when the National Guard went into Kent State, they didn't go there and start handing out flowers. Now, some of you that were alive back then, I wasn't, obviously, but you know, you might say, well, they shouldn't have done what they did, but you got to understand that they were actively being engaged by militant leftists, and then they fired back. The cameras didn't start rolling until it showed that the National Guard were shooting up these innocent college students, right? It's all a game. It's all a game. And they knew that they could root out military from the inside out. You know, should things in this country continue to deteriorate, and I definitely think that they will, how many fighters will there be from the military who are even going to stand up for the Constitution of the United States? I'm not so sure that there's going to be many. I'm not so sure. A lot of my friends, and I've been out for a minute now, and it's kind of hard to believe because it feels like I just left. But a lot of my friends I was in with are all out. There's only two that I know of that are still in, and they're counting down the days. They're short timing. And it's sad. It's sad. You know, a lot of the lessons that the combat experience that we took away from the battlefield, both from Iraq and Afghanistan, that institutional knowledge that we were building, a lot of it went away. And, you know, one of the questions that we had back then was, you know, if the Obama administration does a lot of these crazy things, where will we stand on that? With a couple of very rare exceptions, pretty much all my guys and everybody I worked with, you know, we were all in agreement on that, on where we stood. And, you know, today, I don't know if I'm so sure. I doubt that the same could be said. And, you know, they created a climate of fear, too, of, you know, you better watch what you say, or you know, somebody will come take you away, or you'll get a bad NCOER, or, you know, whatever. And a lot of that institutional combat knowledge and that training and experience and just good soldiering, you know, is all left. I mean, because when you take some of those salty good old boys who made a career in the Army as professional ass kickers and really enjoyed it and know what they're doing, they're not going to put up with certain things. They're just not. And, you know, having to put up with Tommy wearing lipstick over here at the end of the formation and can't figure out what bathroom he needs to go to, or she, or whatever, you know, and these people are always looking for an excuse to get you in trouble if you're the one in charge. Yeah, it's just, it doesn't work. But, you know, it's by design. And a lot of my friends, when I was in, we all kind of came to the same agreement. That was one of the many reasons that I got out. And that leads me to my next point. So while Bracken's assertions are exactly right, I don't disagree with those, not one bit. And, you know, we've had that conversation behind the scenes about a lot of this stuff. What I will say that should give you hope is this. A lot of the guys that saw this and they saw the writing on the wall got out and they took their experience with them. One of them is talking to you right now, but there's a whole lot of us out there. There's a heck of a lot of us out there, and we're here to help you. We're on your side. Are you on ours? So this segment is brought to you by American Partisan site affiliate armslist.com. Do you ever want that Craigslist type classified ads, but for guns? Yep. ArmsList, that is the way to go. Get on there, all 50 states, a lot of firearms, a lot of really good deals on firearms. I know that I have personally picked up a lot of good buys off of ArmsList over the years, and I am very proud to say that we have them as a site affiliate. So go check them out, hit up some people on there, and you never know, you might even find a shooting buddy or two. armslist.com. So coming off of last weekend, we had the RTO course, and man, I had an amazing crowd in there, overflowing with people. The biggest class that I have taught yet, and man, you could just feel the energy in there. It was just it really was great to be in there with that number of patriots and just people that really were there to learn, and I truly enjoyed it. And among some of those lessons, those takeaways that just keep getting reinforced in every class is the whole analog versus digital debate. You know, and with that, when it came to our practical exercises and our big group scenario that I put everybody through on Sunday of the course, one of the things that they learn and one of the takeaways is that keeping your gear as analog only and running it as simply as possible is oftentimes a very serious benefit. So what do I mean by that? So, you know, a lot of people say, well, I want digital encryption and, you know, want all this gear that can't be broken by, you know, no such agency or SIGINT guys that are on the ground doing the LLVI, or low-level voice intercept stuff. All that's true. There's a lot of misconceptions with that, too. You know, when we sit and say, anything can be intercepted and anything can be broken down and anything can be direction found, that much is true. I mean, it is. But the reality is that for it to be intercepted, first and foremost, oftentimes, especially with a handheld, you have to be close enough to them to the sender to be able to even intercept them. I mean, you know, this is where not having a huge amount of range out of your handhelds really comes in handy. So, you know, with that said, the other thing is, what is the level of training in your group? I mean, what is their level of capability? So when people come to the RTO course, I don't require any prior experience or even having any equipment. Just come out, come as you are, because that serves a number of critical training goals. The first one is that it mimics reality. I mean, you know, when the chips are down and later on down the road, you might have those people that come out of the woodwork. They don't have any communications gear. They don't have any experience in combo stuff, but they have a bunch of other skills doing other stuff. Hey, man, that's great because everybody brings something to the table. Your task, though, as the combo guy or somebody who has a clue about a clue, is to train them and to be able to show them, okay, this is what right looks like, and this is how we are going to set up our communications network. And it's frustrating because these things take time to do. It's not a plug and play affair. It's not something that you can just pick up and you instinctually know how to use. And this is probably that point where a few people who are listening to this are going to say, well, yeah, maybe I'll just use those Walmart handhelds because they are. Well, I'm going to shy you away from those. And the people that have been to class, whether it's the SIGINT class or the RTO courses, they know exactly why. They're channelized. You can't control what frequencies they are transmitting on, and they are very, very easy to jam if somebody knows what they're doing. On the other hand, using something like a Baofeng UV5R has a huge advantage because this radio is completely front panel programmable. I can just dial in whatever frequency I want to go to, whatever it is that I want to use, and then I can. You know, and as long as all of the radios in my group are all set up the same way, you know, whether I'm doing that through a computer with a programming cable or whether I'm doing that by hand, which is still not that complicated, you know, it's going to work. It's going to work. Going digital, on the other hand, has kind of a learning curve to it. You know, I favor DMR these days. Originally, I was a big fan of DPMR, which is digital personal mobile radio. The only problem with DPMR is you just can't get those units anymore. I would still be using them, and the ones that I have work very well. It's just you can't get them anymore in a measurable quantity. So, I mean, there's some that pop up here and there, but it's not consistent. DMR, on the other hand, is. And that Baofeng DM1701 or 1701 is really, it's a better radio. It's actually really well built, and it feels like something that I might, you know, I could drop it on concrete or something and it'd probably be okay. It's made out of high impact plastic. It doesn't feel like a McDonald's toy. And, you know, so that UV5R is not really the most durable thing in the world. But then again, on the other hand, as I show everybody in class, the two that we use in class I've had since 2013. And one of them got dropped and buried and stepped on in frozen creek mud on my farm where we train. And it's still working. I mean, you know, I wouldn't go scuba diving with it. And I don't necessarily know if I would use it in every situation. But it's still working, man. So, you know, you gotta put a win in its column for that alone. But the fact that they're so inexpensive, you know, there's no reason not to own a bunch of them. You know, probably 10, 15 of them. It's like having extra mags for your weapon. I mean, there's just no reason. I can't see a relevant reason not to have them. But talking about those digital units, DM1701s, they're a lot more complicated to use. A lot more complicated. And I've had people that bring them to class. They bought them based on the recommendations that I've made. And they bring them to class, but they've never used them. And that's fine. That's fine. That's why you're bringing it to class. But with that said, they don't understand exactly how it is that they work. They don't understand the ins and outs of the controls. And we literally don't have enough class time for me to sit and reprogram everybody's radio. I don't have time to do that. I can tell you step by step how you go through and work a UV5R because we do have time for that. But when it comes to the actual training goals that I have for you out in the field, we can't really accomplish those tasks if we're sitting there and fiddling with DM1701s and DMR, right? So with that said, taking a few steps back, one of the big things that the class noticed was that they wanted to use the DMRs. They wanted to get hands-on with the encryption in particular and the text messaging mode, the SMS mode, because that way you're not having to sit there and press and talk. You can just write that salute report or that SALT report out in a real quick text message and send it over the air. Problem was that none of them knew how to operate those radios. And the ones that did, the radios started giving them a couple of problems here and there that were just control, graphic user interface, GUI issues. And, you know, it was 100% operator error, but they were having a bunch of issues. And so when I broke the two teams down, they weren't able to communicate with one another using them because they couldn't figure out exactly how to get this set up based on their SOI, which is their signals operating instructions. So what do? We went back to analog. We went back to the most basic format, right? Got them set up with their analog stuff. They did their radio check, got their exchange back and forth, know that their communications gear is working, and we hit the field, right? So the point is, you may want all this, you know, encryption and high-tech stuff, and that's all really good, and you should from a communication security standpoint. However, do not fall into the pitfall of realizing that your communications gear needs to be also simple to operate and easy for everyone to understand. Because you're going to run into a situation at some point where you're going to have inexperienced people trying to use the radio. And if they can't effectively operate it, then guess what? You've got a problem on your hands. You can't be the only one who knows how to use your combo gear in your group. It needs to be rugged. Rugged means simple, and simple means reliable. So this segment's brought to you by Gun Mag Warehouse. What's going to be the next thing to have a run? Ammo, firearms if you can find them, food. How about mags? You got enough mags? 10 mags for a fighting weapon is not enough. If you got 10, you need 20. If you have 20, you need 40. Do you have enough? As I tell everybody in a carbine course, your magazines are expendable. You should always try to retain them if at all possible. But if you find yourself in a bad situation, is it going to be you or is it going to be that $10 mag? Gun Mag Warehouse has got you covered. They have a very consistent stock. And if they don't have something in stock, sign up, get that email notification in your inbox, and go over there and get what you need. They have some of the best prices I've found on AK mags, especially Bulgarian polymer mags, which are what I favor in my AKs. I think that you're going to like what they have, so go check them out. I want to come back to a topic that I wrote about week before last. I had a few posts up concerning non-tactical vehicles. Because I've gotten several emails about it, and I've had folks who are asking questions about non-tactical vehicles. It's definitely worthy of diving deeper into. So, bottom line up front, I had people that were asking about do-it-yourself run flats. And do-it-yourself run flats are not nearly as difficult as what you might think. You know, really all you need is an inner tube, and anybody that grew up on a farm, you know, anywhere, this Midwest, South, wherever, farmers and inner tubes are pretty much synonymous with one another. I mean, you know, if you got a old farmer with an old tractor, normally he's going to have inner tubes with water in them in at least the back tires, especially on a cultivating tractor. Well, you know, us in the four-wheeling community, ATV enthusiasts and four-wheel drives, rock climbing, rock crawling, the mudding community somewhat, but not as much. You know, a lot of us ran inner tubes in our tires and beadlocks as well so that we could run the pressure all the way down to almost nothing, run that tire flat, and it's not going to jump off of the bead. So basically the rim won't lose the tires. So beadlocks are a really good way to do that. Inner tubes inside the tire is a really good way to do that. And a product called slime. Slime is this green goo. It's kind of like a glue, kind of like you know, Nickelodeon slime kind of stuff. Like it's got that same texture. And what it does is it seals up holes that might get punctured in your tires. So while all that's really good, the other thing I'll say is this. You know, unless you have a massive budget, and I do know some folks, I've had some people in class who do have massive budgets to do this. But unless you have a massive budget to up-armor your vehicle, using bullet-resistant glass and bullet-resistant panels for the radiator and engine compartment and whatnot, you know, you're kind of stuck with what you're stuck with. And, you know, I put up a couple of Russian videos that was put out by Kalashnikov Concern overseas, and of them shooting up vehicles and showing the real-world damage that different rounds do to different vehicles that are out there. And I thought that it was a really good video because it gives that realistic look at, hey, you know, this isn't Hollywood. This is what it actually does. You know, I saw an Afghan border police vehicle. It was a Ford Ranger. And Ford Rangers overseas are different than Ford Rangers here in the States. But this Ford Ranger got just chewed up in an ambush. I mean, just lit up. And, you know, unfortunately, the four guys that were inside of it and the couple of guys that were in the bed, they didn't make it. But, man, I just remember seeing the damage from that. And it was, you know, I saw vehicles get shot up and blown up in Iraq. But this one was just a whole new level because it was a close ambush with AKs. And, man, they chewed this vehicle all to pieces. And it was AKs only. They weren't using any other weapons with that. And that always stuck out in my mind of, you know, this is a civilian non-tactical vehicle getting just the crap shot out of it along with the people inside of it and just the damage that it's able to do. You know, shooting into vehicles with the M4 didn't always yield the best results. 62 grain green tip penetrator, you know, it would go through the vehicle and it, you know, auto glass would deflect it somewhat. 55 grain is actually even worse for this. 77 grain, on the other hand, does pretty well. But that AK round, you know, the 123, 124 grain, full metal jacket, boat tails they were using over there, the M67 rounds, man, they would tear a vehicle all to pieces. And the lesson behind that is this. We've got a plethora of different types of weapons at work in the States. I mean, you know, when things go sideways, when the world goes sideways, we, you know, the chips are going to fall where they are. And you could be ambushed by anything from a 7mm mag to an AR-15 to an AK to, you know, whatever, to a 22 Magnum. But, you know, with that said, understand that your vehicles have a very specific role when it comes to patrolling. You're not patrolling from a vehicle. You know, I've had people in the past, particularly when I got out of the Army, my own local network guys that I train with, and you know, a few of them have come and gone here and there. But I had one in particular who had experience in Iraq, and he had some personal issues and whatnot. And his thing was he wanted to build this overland vehicle, jacked up the big rock crawler tires and stuff that was going to be his bug out vehicle that he was going to fight off the Reds with or whatever. And I'm laughing because he was serious about this. Yeah. And I know a lot of people kind of fall into that trap. you know, for me, a vehicle has to be practical. I mean, I love my built Jeeps. I've owned two of them. You know, I have fun with my trucks and ATV and everything else. But, you know, it's just not practical to sit and say that I'm going to be doing a movement to contact in this crazy bug out vehicle that I sunk a ton of money into that, you know, looks like a Baja rock crawler. I mean, it's just not, that's not practical. But also, I mean, you're not going to be working out of a vehicle. A vehicle, a non-tactical vehicle, has some very specific purposes. And let's talk about the difference between what is a tactical vehicle versus non-tactical vehicle. So a non-tactical vehicle means it is not designed to withstand the rigors of combat. It is not armored. There's no real safeguards to protect the people inside of it, right? A tactical vehicle is something like a MATV, an MRAP, a Bradley fighting vehicle, so on and so forth. They've got armor on them. They're designed to withstand combat, getting shot at, getting shot up, and protect the people on the inside of it. A non-tactical vehicle is not really designed to do that. It is a civilian vehicle that is adapted to a specific role, whatever that role might be. So you have to understand that a non-tactical vehicle, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, your Honda Civic or your Ford Super Duty or your, you know, your mom's minivan, whatever it is a support vehicle, right? You're not patrolling out of it. It is there for your team's insertion, for dropping them off, getting them into an area, right? Extraction, meaning you're getting them out of that area, or it is used for resupply. It's one of those three roles, okay, or all three of those roles. You're not really going to be using it for much else. It's just not. With that said, one of the biggest things and considerations that you need to make is having medical equipment in that vehicle, right? So if I've got a team on the ground, say there's a disturbance somewhere in some town in North Carolina, and I'm dropping my team off, our non-tactical vehicle's role, and you're going to have somebody that stays with the vehicle, it's typically going to be the driver, but its role is first insertion, then extraction, but it has medical equipment on hand, right? I've got extra medical gear that my individual guys that are on the ground, it is a higher tier than what they're going to have. Right, so let's say I'm working in a non-permissive environment. I'm going to have some tourniquets. I'm going to have an NPA to open my airway. Right, I'm going to have some probably a compression bandage and a clotting agent. Well, I mean, that's what you got. What you got is what you got. Immediate aid if you get shot, blast injury, whatever the case might be. That is the role of an IFAC, right? But in that non-tactical vehicle, you're setting that up for a higher tier of care. So we've had that immediate aid. We're stopping the bleeding. We're keeping that airway open. Now we're going to get to our vehicle where we might have, should have, if we're squared away, we're going to have additional clotting agents. We're going to have a hyphen chest seal if you've taken a round to the chest, right? We're going to have equipment in there to be able to look at you, maybe a pair of trauma shears, should have a pair of trauma shears on at least one person on your team, but two is one is none, right? So you're setting that vehicle up to begin a higher tier of care. Now, you're probably saying, well, you know, that's going to take a fairly large vehicle, and you're right, it does. So while I made that joke about mom's minivan, mom's minivan actually makes a pretty good ambulance. You got a lot of room to work, especially if you pull the back seats out of it. A lot of SUVs that are out there today, even midsize SUVs, are very spacious on the insides of them. And, you know, when all else fails, pickup truck. Pickup trucks are very popular for a reason. Throw a camper shell on it, and you're good to go in the back of there. So something to think about, you know. And another rule for a non-tactical vehicle, or NTV, is being able to blend in. You know, if you look around and say, well, what's the most average car that's in my area? Well, that's probably what you ought to be driving. I mean, don't stand out. You don't really want to be putting a bunch of stickers, you know, I believe this or I believe that. I mean, I got a couple of cool guy stickers on my range truck. You know, this is Infidel on the back of it, and got an AK, and, you know, got my my Desert Tan combat flag and all that. But, you know, on my daily driver, that's not a daily driver. On my daily driver vehicles, you know, I don't have anything. They're slick. I don't need to tell the world what I believe. You know, that's on me, right? That's on me. I don't need to sit there and talk about it over and over again, right? But I also have vehicles that are very common in my operating environment. They blend in anywhere. They blend in anywhere. I mean, my truck looks like it could be on any tobacco farm anywhere in North Carolina and blend in, and has been. You know, it there's nothing out of the ordinary. You know, it just looks like a beat up old farmer's truck, because that's exactly what it is. The cars are the same way. You know, daily drivers are the same way. You blend in anywhere. And that's a big advantage. You know, if you need to start thinking about working in a non-permissive environment. And, you know, even if you've lived in an area for forever, it could quickly become a non-permissive environment for you. And the ability to blend in with your surroundings and not stand out in a crowd is a big, big first step, right? You know, the other things, two other notes that I have on there is, you know, I always carry an extra combat load during extraction too. You know, working in a non-permissive environment, you don't really have the capability of carrying a bunch of mags and other stuff on your chest, right, or on your battle belt. It just looks a little odd. So you might have room to carry, you know, for me, for example, I can conceal carry inside the waistband, appendix inside the waistband, carry Glock 19, and it disappears on me. I can carry two extra mags that disappear on me as well. You know, but we don't typically walk around out in the open carrying an M4 or an AK or, you know, whatever your rifle of choice is, right? We don't do that. And people also don't normally walk around with chest rigs on, just, you know, in public. It's just not something we do. So you want to have that extra combat load, normally two combat loads, inside of your non-tactical vehicle, right, inside your NTV. Because the reality is that if you're having to make a hasty extraction, you might be getting into a gunfight. The key to getting into a gunfight during an extraction is rapid battlefield dominance. Rapid battlefield dominance is, it is attaining fire superiority. All right, you want to keep whatever was shooting at you and trying to kill you, you want to keep their heads down until you can get off the X. And keep in mind, that vehicle is going to become a massive bullet magnet. You know, me personally, if I see that there's a team trying to do an extraction, perform an extraction in a non-tactical vehicle, then I'm shooting up the vehicle. You know, it's just that, because I know what my rounds will do to that vehicle. First, I'm going to target the engine compartment. The tires, you know, you can shoot those up and they're going to still make it off the X probably, unless their tires were already close to being worn out. But if they're decent, they're still going to make it off the X for the most part, just not as quickly or handling as well. But if you shoot up the engine compartment, tear up that radiator, hit some of the stuff that's on the outside of the motor. And these days, with the advent of aluminum engines, man, your average intermediate rifle cartridge, a 5.56, 7.62 by 39, they're going to tear an engine compartment up in a hurry, in a real hurry. And then you can deal with the people who are inside. So with that, keeping that in mind, you know, when you're getting out of there, that team should be establishing fire superiority. And, you know, if you're getting into a gunfight with that vehicle around, it becomes a bullet magnet and you are in real trouble. You know, cast aside the Hollywood stuff. You know, those vehicles are getting chewed up. You can shoot through a car door real, real easy. And again, you know, I'm going to put up a link down below to those Russian videos. You should go check those out. And see real world what those rifle rounds will do to a vehicle. Anyhow, with that said, folks, episode 25, if you have been listening from the beginning, I really can't thank you enough for putting up with me. This is a heck of a lot of fun to make podcasts. It's not something I ever really intended on doing. It has been a supplemental exercise to the classes that I run and really just another creative outlet. Any way that I can share content with you, and hopefully you're able to get something out of it. You know, and if not, well, let me know what I can do better. Shoot me an email. If you've got any questions, brushbeater@tutanota.com. That is brushbeater@tutanota.com. And more than happy to answer them on air. You know, it's a pretty efficient use of time to be able to talk to you like this. And I really appreciate what this audience has done. The warm reception that we have received, the fact that we have so many people reading the site on a daily basis. You know, there's a lot of hope for this country. There's a lot of hope for the good people of this nation. A lot of it. Never lose sight of that, folks. Never, ever, ever lose sight of that. And your role is to be prepared for what comes next. But just know that we're going to make it on the other side. I'll talk to you soon.